welcome to iFormRx, where we discuss the evidence that matters to ambulatory care pharmacy practice. And today's guest on our podcast is Dr. Katie Kaiser from South College in Tennessee. Dr. Kaiser will be discussing with us her commentary regarding the Orbit AF Registry study, which examined outcomes from patients who received anticoagulation bridge therapy. Thanks for joining us today, Katie, on the iFormRx podcast. If you had to summarize in just four sentences or less the Orbit AF Bridge Registry study to someone who hasn't read the paper, what would you say?
Thanks, Stuart. The Orbit AF Registry stands for Outcomes Registry for Better Informed Treatment of AFib. So that gives you a little bit better idea of the outcomes that they were trying to assess. So we want to be informed practitioners, and so this is what they were looking at. It was designed to look at patients with AFib in the usual ambulatory care that they would experience. And so part of that prospective data collection was the clinical decisions around temporary oral anticoagulation interruption for a procedure. And so they looked at whether that bridge therapy was used. If so, what kind of bridge therapy was used, and then the adverse effects or events that occurred around that, so mainly bleeding or clotting. And so the results showed that about 25% of those patients who did have an interruption in their therapy were bridged with some kind of rapid-acting agent, and that they were actually more likely to have had a history of stroke or a heart valve, a mechanical heart valve in particular. And these patients who received bridge therapy were also more likely to experience an adverse event like bleeding, which we would expect, but also there was a trend towards more thromboembolic events and cardiovascular hospitalizations, which I don't think we necessarily would have expected.
So, Katie, the results of this study suggest that routinely bridging anticoagulation therapy isn't always helpful and may be harmful in some patients. Do you think we should avoid anticoagulation bridging, or are there particular patient populations you feel would still benefit?
Well, the results of the study definitely raise a lot of questions about how we currently approach perioperative procedure in patients who are on chronic anticoagulation. I don't think that we should avoid anticoagulation bridging altogether, and there's definitely more specific evidence about the risk and benefits in a variety of patient populations that we need. In the practice of evidence-based medicine, you know, there's still always a focus on patient-specific assessment, balancing the risk of bleeding and the risk of thrombosis during any kind of perioperative interruption in their therapy. I do think that there are patient populations that benefit from anticoagulation bridging, such as many of those currently classified as high risk in the CHEST guidelines. For example, those might be patients with mitral mechanical heart valves, those with CHADS 2 scores of 5 or more, and although the CHEST guidelines don't talk about CHADS 2 VASC, perhaps those patients as well that have, say, a score of 6 or more may also be considered high risk. Patients who've had a stroke or TIA within the previous, say, 3 to 6 months, depending on other risk factors they may have. And definitely patients who've had, although this trial isn't looking at this, had a thromboembolic event, venous thromboembolic event within the previous 3 months, or have a thrombophilia like protein C or S deficiencies, would also, I think, would be considered high risk and should be using bridge therapy.
So anticoagulation bridging is typically done using a low molecular weight heparin because they have a rapid onset and have a relatively short duration of effect, about 12 hours or so. Another option would be to use one of the new oral anticoagulants to bridge warfarin therapy because they, like a low molecular weight heparin, have a rapid onset and relatively short duration of effect. Using these agents for this purpose is largely untested, but what are your thoughts? Would they potentially make the practice of bridging safer?
Wow, Stuart, this is really a loaded question. There's definitely different schools of thought with this, and I think every practitioner out there has probably thought about, you know, the use of these newer oral anticoagulant agents in this setting. There are many patient and agent-related variables to consider when we use any rapid-acting anticoagulant for bridge therapy. So many of us think about renal function, of course, and that kind of plays true for all of these. So it doesn't necessarily differentiate them, but it is a consideration. So in particular with the newer oral anticoagulants, I think that if a patient were already on one of these agents, for an approved indication, and then they needed to have some kind of procedure, then I think that they could potentially have a smoother perioperative process in regards to stopping the therapy and restarting, and potentially could decrease their risk of adverse effects by being able to stay on the same agent that they were previously on. But currently, you know, I think the main issue is the uncertainty with how these newer agents, how we accurately assess the patient's anticoagulation status, for one, and also the lack of having a specific reversal agent really keep practitioners cautious about using these agents in general, and in particular with the strategy around perioperative procedures. There's also a consideration for the black box warning that are also on these agents. I think that it kind of lingers in our mind about they have an increased risk of thrombosis when you do discontinue these agents, and potentially that might be a risk at that time as well. And I'm not for sure that we really know how to interpret that data and take that black box warning and how we use that in practice, because obviously there are lots of patients on these agents on appropriate approved indications, and there are going to be times when they need to come off of them. As a general commentary on this thought, I think that patients in general would really appreciate being able to have an agent that was oral to utilize instead of an injectable. I think the strategy could potentially be less expensive when I've looked at the cost of, say, enoxaparin versus some of these newer oral anticoagulants. It would be less expensive and may be more readily available from an access standpoint. I think a lot of times patients have issues being able to go to their local pharmacy of choice, and they readily have available, you know, a dose of enoxaparin that they need, whereas they may be more likely to have these agents on their shelf already for dispensing.
Well, Katie, I gather there are some patient populations when you think bridging therapy really is necessary if you have to temporarily discontinue warfarin therapy. Given the risks of this practice, are there particular patient management strategies that you'd recommend to minimize these risks?
Absolutely. I think from my experience, first and foremost, there needs to be a perioperative management process that patients go through. So the first would be an assessment, of course, of their risk of having a clot based on their indication. And secondly, an assessment of their risk of bleeding during that time frame. And I think that that probably sounds obvious, but oftentimes I think that those steps get missed. So addressing these issues will help determine whether the antithrombotic that they're on, mainly we're talking about warfarin at this point, would be interrupted at all. Because obviously there are a lot of procedures that we consider low risk for bleeding that they would not even need to be off of their therapy, and thus would decrease their risk of having both the bleeding and the thrombosis around that time frame. So if bridging anticoagulation is needed, then I think using a detailed periprocedural anticoagulation dosing form or calendar is really the best way to go. So this clearly explains every single day of both the pre- and post-procedure time frame and exactly what doses and of what medications the patient should or should not be taking. And this is very important to be clear about, and when, you know, when the medications are discontinued. So that also includes, obviously, their primary oral anticoagulant, but also any other antiplatelets or other medications that may be affecting their clotting. And when the bridge agents obviously should be started, the doses that they should be, how they should be administered, and when that last dose in particular should be taken before the procedure, because you don't want to give them a dose too close to that procedure no matter what the agent is. And then obviously the final and most vital component that I think of in that periprocedural dosing calendar would be to proactively schedule that post-procedure follow-up appointment with you. And I think that should be anywhere from about 7 to 14 days after their procedure. And that all depends on, obviously, the patient's risk of thrombosis or bleeding during that time period, what bridging strategy you use, their stability on their oral anticoagulant beforehand, and the procedure that's being done. All these kinds of things factor in to when you would decide to schedule that appointment. But if you go ahead and schedule it and have it on the books, for one, maybe the patient just shows up at that time, and that's great. And if not, it will be a reminder to you as their practitioner to follow up with that process and where are they and what happened.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kaiser, for being with us here today on the iFormRx podcast regarding the Orbit AF Registry study and examining anticoagulation bridging strategies, their safety and effectiveness. We'd love to hear your thoughts on iFormRx. Leave us a comment or two. Until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormRx.